Today's Teisho will be on case 64 in the Heikigan Roku. The Blue Rock Collection. Case 64 is entitled, Joshu Puts His Sandals on His Head. Main subject. Nansen told a story to Joshu and asked his opinion. Joshu then took off his sandals and, putting them on his head, went away. Nansen said, if you had been there, the cat would have been saved. Secho's verse. He asked Joshu to complete the koan. It was their leisure time in Chang'an. The sandals on the head, who had guessed? Returning home, they were at rest. Some of you may be new to Zen, and you may not understand much about the text I just read. In Zen, we use, or in this particular school of Zen, we use what are called koans, and koans are subjects for meditation. So, when you begin Zen practice, you learn how to focus your mind, to make your mind still, and to enter a special state of consciousness known as samadhi. If you have done meditation before, you know the basic outline, the basic procedure. You sit down on the cushion, you get into the appropriate posture, you begin to breathe from your abdominal region, your dantian or your hara. You squeeze the breath out and you watch the breath. This is an elementary form of meditation practice that's used throughout the Buddhist world and is really throughout the Indian world as well. Hindu people also learn to meditate in this way. When you sit down on the cushion and you straighten your back and you get into the appropriate posture and you watch your breath, all kinds of things can be going through your head. You might come into the meditation hall and you could have a lot of problems. You know, maybe you have a test coming up, or maybe you have a big report that's due at work. Maybe you're having problems with a coworker, you know, and when you come to meditate, all of these things could be circulating in your mind. You know, you could be trying to think about what you're going to strategize, about what you're going to do next week. You could be rehearsing possible encounters with a difficult colleague in your head and thinking about how you're going to handle it. You know, this is a particular kind of consciousness. This particular kind of consciousness. Ordinary consciousness, so-called, is very much centered on ourselves and our practical needs and practical tasks. So, you know, as you're driving here to meditate this morning, you might have been making a mental note that you're out of cat food and you have to get some cat food on the way home. This mind is a calculating mind, and it tends to be rather self-centered. So all the time, this form of consciousness is thinking about how to make my life work, what I have to do to achieve my goals, and so on. And it tends to be a rather rational mind, at least on the surface, and very practical, you know. When you are in this mind, you might write things down. You might even write in complete sentences, you know. When you come to meditate, you might be meditating simply because you have stress or you have life problems and you want to work with them. lot of people practice meditation just for stress release. And that's a perfectly good motive for practicing meditation. When you sit down on the cushion and you start to watch your breath, and you breathe properly from your diaphragm, you squeeze the breath out, and you follow the breath out with your mind, you'll quickly enter a different state of consciousness, which is not quite ordinary waking consciousness. It's not the consciousness that says, I have to get some cat food on the way home from the store, I'll stop at the gas station, I have some things I need to pick up with the dry cleaner. When is that report due? Is it next week? Maybe I'll work on that Sunday night, and so on. It's not that consciousness. When you sit down on the cushion and you watch your breath, you'll begin to notice that your consciousness takes on a different form. It's not as crisp and clear. It's more like fragments of thoughts or memories rolling through your head. You're descending, you could say, from one level of your consciousness to another as you watch the breath. The breath is a marvelous device for taking you down through the layers of your mind. If you follow the breath, it's going to take you right, it'll take some practice, but gradually the breath is going to take you deeper and deeper through the layers of your mind. This is one of the most remarkable things about just watching the breath, that it has this quality. The Buddha himself taught meditating on the breath. That was one of the most elementary forms of meditation that he taught. And as I said, it's used in all the Buddhist schools, Tibetan Buddhism, Theravada, Zen. You watch the breath and it begins to take you down through the layers of the mind. Most people don't watch the breath at all. They breathe, but they're not paying attention to the breath. And if they pay attention to the breath, they don't pay attention long enough to begin to notice a transformation in the character of their awareness. In fact, usually even people who meditate don't necessarily notice that they're undergoing a transformation when they meditate. But if you pay attention, you really begin to change, your consciousness really begins to change when you move from that top level of the mind, which is making calculations and is thinking about how to achieve your goals and protect yourself and advance your interests and so on. You begin to drop down to this next layer, which is like pieces of thoughts or fragments of thoughts, images, some emotion can come up. If you keep watching the breath will take you down through that layer to another place. It usually takes a lot of practice to get to that, get through that layer, and get to a place where your mind becomes very still. But people who practice meditation at first, they enjoy the relaxation aspect. So if you meditate 10 or 15 minutes a day, within a couple of weeks, when you sit down on the cushion and you meditate for, say, 15 minutes, you will have a deep relaxation response. It'll just happen automatically. It takes practice, but you will sit down on the cushion and it's just like all the pressure will go away after 15 minutes and you'll feel much better. A lot of people quit at that moment. They're really sitting for stress release, and after about 15 minutes they get their stress release. But 15 minutes is not really enough meditation to accomplish, is not enough time, rather, to really meditate. The first 15 minutes you're just sort of getting the mind stabilized. And as you're watching the breath and you're counting your out-breaths, your mind is going to become more and more calm and focused. And after about 15 minutes, it's just like, ah. Now, if you get off the cushion at that point, you might have to do it. You might have a busy schedule. But if you stay on the cushion, other things can happen. So, you know, actually, after about 15 minutes, your mind is really ready to meditate. So when people say, I meditate 15 minutes a day, I respect their commitment, but it's not really meditation. You really have to get through that deep relaxation response, and then you continue to watch your breath, and you'll notice that the breath eventually is going to take you to a place beyond those fragments of thoughts. It's going to take you to a place where your mind begins to become very still. So if you watch the breath, you watch the first breath, you watch the second breath, you watch the third breath, after about three breaths, your mind is going to start to wander if you're just a beginner. And you'll start thinking about your job, or you'll think about a movie you saw last night, or you'll think about a relationship. Maybe you're going off on a vacation and you'll be having fantasies about your vacation. When you realize, wait a minute, I'm not watching my breath, you come back to the breath. And then after a couple breaths, you go back into this movie, mental movie in your head. And then you realize you're not watching your breath and you come back. There's a period in your training where it's very difficult. You know, you're just sitting on the cushion and you're struggling to get beyond your thoughts. You're struggling to get down under that layer of the mind, which is like fragments of thoughts, like this torrent of pieces of thoughts or torrent of images. The top layer of the mind is really like consciousness, waking consciousness. But the second layer of the mind is like this almost dreamlike. It's a little bit dreamy, and it's really not coherent sentences. It's really not coherent ideas. It's like you're entering a stream of consciousness, which is right on the edge of unconsciousness. And the logic of the mind at that level is associative, you know. So you're thinking of dinner, and then you think of your mother, and she's making dinner, and you're 5 years old. And then you think about her eyes, and then you think about the eyes of your partner. Or then you think about your worries in some way that are related. So it's like associative. That layer of the mind works on these associative principles. You know. Beginning meditators have to struggle. You know, you're sitting on the cushion. You're trying to focus on your breath. You watch the breath for three or four breaths, and then you go off into space. You realize you're not in the moment. You're not with your breath. You come back. And it's a struggle. There's a period in meditation practice where you're just struggling on the cushion. But if you don't get discouraged and you continue, you know, sooner or later, you're going to notice that as you follow the breath out, the breath takes you to this very still place. Right at the end of your breath, there's a little interval between the time you exhale all the air and you begin to inhale again. There's a little interval. And when you follow the breath out and you get to that little place, that little interval, it's very, very still. And that's sort of where you want to go when you follow your breath. You watch the breath go out, out, out. Right at the end of the breath, there's this stillness or this blankness. And this is really where you want to go. You know, most people, myself included, you know, when I started doing meditation, I really was just coming to Zen because I was very stressed and even more unhappy than I realized. I think my stress masked my unhappiness, you know. I had a job, and I was going to graduate school, and then I was in graduate school, and I had a lot of stresses, and I guess I wasn't very happy. And I would come and sit on the cushion at the Seattle Zen Center, and I would always leave feeling better than when I came. And I didn't always conceptualize it and say, oh, I feel better than when I came. But I just kind of instinctively kept coming back because the meditation made me feel better. I never really thought about the transformation of consciousness or anything of the kind. In fact, I didn't really notice it. I would just sit down, watch my breath. It would be a big struggle, but when I got up, I would feel a lot better. You know, sooner or later, if you meditate, sooner or later, you're going to sit down on the cushion and you're going to have a wonderful, wonderful experience. I'm not fond of describing meditation as bliss, you know, but actually, sooner or later, if you practice meditation regularly, you will sit down on the cushion and you will have a sit every once in a while, which is really quite wonderful, really blissful. And people have come up to me after a meditation period and said, what was that? That was so wonderful, you know. And it might not be like your head is blown off, but it might be just very, very pleasant. People have a very powerful sense of well-being or safety. And this happens when you've crossed that threshold into the stillness, which is under that layer of sort of stream of consciousness. So you start at the top layer of the mind, which is the thinking mind or the discriminating mind. Then you go through the stream of consciousness and you get to this still place, and often that's accompanied by a feeling of like profound well-being or deep connectedness or safety. People experience that state in different ways. You know, sometimes you're in that state, which we call samadhi, you feel very empty. You might feel like your body has disappeared and all you can feel is your face and your hands, or you feel like your hands have disappeared. Some people feel like they're floating. Some people feel like they're hollow. You may or may not have these physical sensations. You may not, you're really just experiencing your body in a different way. As your consciousness changes, your experience of your own body changes with it. And basically, we experience our body ordinarily through the channel of our discriminating mind. So actually, many of us look at our bodies in a very alienated way or very detached way, like they're not really us, you know. So I suppose everybody has the experience of looking at themselves in the mirror and being unhappy, you know. I myself sometimes get up in the morning and look at myself in the mirror and I'm shocked to see that I'm not 30 years old anymore, you know. And I'm disappointed to see that my hair is gray, you know. I know that my sister, when I was growing up, sometimes she would be standing in front of the mirror trying to find a pose that looked good to her, right? And she'd look very unhappy and she'd be adjusting her hair and sucking in her stomach and she'd always leave looking very discouraged, you know. So this is a discriminating experience of the body, you know. Sometimes when you're watching a movie or something, you don't notice your body at all, you know. So when we're in a deeper state of consciousness, you know, we experience our body very differently. We're not looking at it from the outside. We're unified with the body, and we experience it in a very different way. You know, so it might feel like you're floating, or you're hollow, or your hands or your face have disappeared. This is, some people feel like they're floating off the cushion, and there are even religious groups who believe that when you meditate, you can levitate. Actually, you can't levitate, but it might feel sometimes like you're floating off the cushion. you're just experiencing your body through a different kind of mental consciousness. And you're not experiencing it from the outside looking in. You're deeply into your body. Your body and your mind have been unified in a way that they're not normally unified when you're in your discriminating consciousness. So, at any rate, once you can enter this state of samadhi in Zen, and you watch your breath, you know, and enter this state of samadhi, your teacher will give you, the teacher will usually give you a koan, what's called a koan, a koan. And koans are a little bit like mantras. You repeat a key phrase or a key part of the koan, and you sort of internalize that phrase. So in this case, this is a story about a great Zen master who was asked a question by his teacher. And in response to the question, he puts his sandals on his head. And if you don't know much about Zen, this might just seem to be very strange or incomprehensible. But you know, the context for this koan, this little story, is, as I've explained, that, you know, basically the point of meditation practice is to move from a kind of a consciousness which experiences the world in a very divided and judgmental way to a consciousness which is very much unified with everything around it. You know, some of you know that I have a pond in my backyard. Many years ago, my neighbors, Fidel and Keith, and I decided to put a pond in our backyard. This is like a little little pond for fish and so on. So we built two little ponds, actually, and we built a little system, like a little artificial a waterfall that takes the water from one pond and puts it in the other, and one pond is lower than the other, so basically when you turn on the pump, there's a pump hidden in the ground, the water comes off, the water is drawn up into this little waterfall and it goes down into one pond, and then that pond flows into the other pond. It never really works, you know, the pump system always breaks, and I have to clean out the tube, and then I get it clean and something else clogs it up, so we actually never turn it on anymore. But it's very beautiful, and some of you have met my wife, and she's this incredible gardener, and she's planted all these plants. But we have a number of frogs who live in our pond, and they're really beautiful. And every morning I get up and go and look for the frogs. And there's a frog in, there's one big frog in each pond. I don't know if they talk to each other or if they each have their own pond. They might be rather territorial. I don't really know. But usually I can find both frogs in their pond. And they're usually up on a rock. So there's a frog in our pond, and there's a frog in Fidel and Keith's pond. And there's actually a stone that has a bunch of moss on it. It's a beautiful mossy rock, and usually the frog is on the moss looking out over his domain, which is this pond. But sometimes the frog is in the water, and the frog is, you know, basically floating in the water. It can be a little alarming the first time I saw it, because I thought my frog is dead, you know. But he wasn't dead, he's just floating. So the frog will jump into the water and then he'll just hang there. And he has these long feet, web feet, and they just hang off in space and his head is above. He floats around the pond like that. I guess that's his enjoyment, that's his break from guarding the pond. Frog is an interesting creature, right? Because, you know, he lives in two domains at once, right? You know, he lives in the water and he lives in the air. I used to have a beloved fish who lived in the pond. His name was Phineas. And he was accidentally killed by my sister-in-law, I'm sorry to report. And he was a wonderful fish. I had a deep relationship with him, and I really was very sad about his death. And he would try to come up out of the water, but he couldn't do it. So when it was feeding time, I would come down and throw some, he was a koi, you know, a golden carp. And I would throw some food, and sometimes he would come up out of the water onto the rock, and he would eat some of the food that was on the rock, and then he'd have to go back into the water. And sometimes when I would come, he would actually come out onto the rock. You know, koi, I think, are very smart fish. And he would come out, and, you know, we didn't really shake hands, but, you know, we could look at each other, you know. And I really loved him, you know. But he wanted to come out in the out of the water and be with me, but he couldn't, you know, and I couldn't really go into the water, you know, or wouldn't go into the water. So, you know, we met in between these two worlds, you know, but a frog lives in both worlds, you know. You know, I think humans are like frogs, you know, actually. You know, we can live in two worlds at once. You know, and that's really, you know, humans are really much more remarkable than they realize. You know, nowadays, you know, we don't necessarily live very much in both worlds. We tend to live in one world only, you know, and that's the world of, like, what we call the human. You know, this is the world where, you know, we use our discriminating minds, and we have goals, and we pursue our goals, and we succeed or fail. And, you know, in my wallet, I have all my identification. You know, so I have my driver's license, I have my Rutgers ID, I have my State of New Jersey, health benefits card, I have my dental card, I have my AAA, you know. If somebody asks me who I am, I can just take out all these cards and show them, right? It has my birthday on the license plate and so on, on the license, driver's license. So this is sort of like the human realm, you know, the human realm. And, you know, you're born at a certain time, you get a certain kind of job, you have a certain status in your job, you know, and so on and so on. This is, you know, you get up in the morning and you worry about this or that. You wonder how you're going to fill the time and amuse yourself, or you're so busy you barely know what to do, right? All day long we're thinking, how do I do this? What would I like? You know, what am I going to have for breakfast this morning? Will it be scrambled eggs? Will it be yogurt? You know, which, eggs or yogurt? Eggs or yogurt? You know, which would make me happier, you know, or maybe you have nothing to eat, you know, which is a difficult situation. So this is like the human realm. It tends to be, with all due respect, tends to be a little self-centered. It has many consolations, right? There's many wonderful things about being a human being, you know, a birthday party, right? You know, that's a wonderful thing. You know, somebody throws you a birthday party, they're celebrating your existence on Earth, which is great. And you're today you're 12 years old. You know, think of that. Think of what, you know, what the, today you're 40 years old. Think of that, you know. And so you know, it's wonderful in a way to have a job. It's actually kind of exciting to have problems. It really is, you know. You have problems, you have goals. These are all things that make life worth living in a certain way, right? They do. It's very important to be a human being. You know, it's really important for me to be Kurt, you know? I have a sister I love. I had a childhood that I remember. You know, it had its ups and downs. You know, I wasn't usually very good at sports, you know? I did some things well and other things not so well, you know. I have all these memories of my personal life, and they're really important to me, and it's important to have a personal life. And it's important to be a person, you know, to be a person. You know, we're not just a number, you know, we're actually a human being. And I have a name, you know, and I have people who love me, and I have people I love, you know. So the human realm is a wonderful place to be, and it's you know, got great depth and richness. You know, I like to read novels and poetry, and I like paintings and things like that. And you know, last weekend I was down in D.C. and my wife and I looked at these paintings by these French artists mostly. And you know, they show people in their domestic lives, and you know, somebody's sitting down with a friend and having a drink, and it's a beautiful painting, you know. Or somebody's ironing, shows a woman ironing, and her child is behind her, and that's one, you know, that's a wonderful thing, to be a human being, to be alive, and so on. So, you know, this is all very rich. Sometimes it loses its flavor, though. It loses its flavor, I think. And we can get to be too trapped in this realm, this perspective. You know, and then we go to our jobs and we think, you know, oh, brother, another day at the job, you know? Or we, you know, you might have a family and you think, oh, brother, you know, these teenagers. My sister's sons are, her older son is just now becoming a teenager. And she had such a good relationship with him, and she said it's really just heartbreaking because he doesn't want to be with her. Very difficult. And I can remember my mother came to school to pick up my brother and me when we were just becoming teenagers. She drove up to the school, school was letting out, and we were hanging out with all our friends trying to impress them with how cool we were. And our mother drove up and she said, come on, boys, let's go, you know, we'll go. We were mortified, right? We don't have a mother, you know? Mother, you know? Who is that, you know? We live in an apartment of our own, you know? So we were like appalled that our mother came to the school and other boys saw that we had a mother, you know, and that's just what little boys go through, you know. It's part of this process of becoming an individual. It hurt my mother so much. Now I realize what a jerk I was, you know. And my mother, I'm sure she went home and just thought, oh, those damn kids, you know, what an ungrateful little brats, you know. So, you know, sometimes the human realm gets to be very confining, you know, It's beautiful and wonderful, but it can become a little claustrophobic, you know. And I think that when we do something like meditation, we sort of step into like a bigger perspective. I think we're like a frog, you know. We can live in these two dimensions at once. You know, one of them is, you could say, like the human realm, where I have my birthday is such and such a date. You know, I'm going to live for so many years. I'm this many years old. You know, I was born in Philadelphia, and so on. But there's this other, we have another part of ourselves that we shouldn't neglect. You know, when we do in the modern world too much. I think the human realm suffers because we don't spend enough time in this other realm. You know. So, you know, when you sit down on the cushion and you enter deep samadhi, you really don't have an age anymore. You don't. You know, so you're not 58 anymore. You're not 58 on the cushion. You're not. You know, if you're in deep samadhi, there really isn't a time doesn't really exist. You know, sometimes the sits seem incredibly long. So if your legs hurt or you're just not in the groove, you know, you're sitting there waiting for somebody to ring the bell, the sits can seem interminably long, right? But when you're in deep samadhi, that sense of time really disappears, sometimes at least. And you're really in this place where there isn't a time. And you're also in this place where you don't experience yourself as the center of your consciousness. You don't. This happens sometimes where people just, when you say, okay, well, where am I in all of this? You're nowhere. Or you seem to be everywhere and nowhere. When you're in deep samadhi, you're in a different consciousness, which is not false. It's not. It's a different way of experiencing the real world, right? And so, you know, when we do meditation, we enter into this different consciousness and experience the world in a very different way. You know, I have a student who once said to me, "When I sit on the cushion, I feel like a god," right? Well, that might be going too far, you know. But you're definitely not in the normal human consciousness. You're in this place where you feel connected to everything around you. Your sense of self is not located in any particular thing. It's like consciousness without a center or consciousness without a self. It's timeless, or it can be timeless. And you have this very profound, perhaps, sense of safety or well-being or connectedness. Now, this is, I've been, you know, basically, if you do a lot of zazen, you spend a lot of time in this state. And in Buddhist literature, this state is thought to be very, very important. You know, sometimes we're like a frog in the water, and we're swimming around in the water, and we see all our other frogs, and they say hello, and they have a birthday party for us, and so on and so on. But then, you know, sometimes we come up above the water, and we enter this other realm. And it's this timeless, selfless realm, which is, you know, described in the Buddhist sutras and in the literature on meditation practice. We call this Buddha mind. It's not a self-centered intelligence. It's an awareness that's connected to everything around it. It's timeless and so on. Experience often feels limitless. You know, so these two things really go together. These two things really belong together. I think in the modern world, my personal feeling is that we suffer because we don't spend enough time coming out of the water and going to this other realm. You know, we get a little too caught up in the frog world under the water. We forget that there's this other dimension. And when we enter this other dimension, it gives the human world a kind of added beauty and emotional depth. You know, if you spend some time in the Buddha mind, when you go back to see your family, it's probably the case that you will be able to respond to them with more love and compassion. You know? You'll be able to go to your job, and you'll be calmer and more helpful to others, you know. And my personal feeling is that our society is not particularly healthy because we don't spend enough time as a society, as a people, in this other dimension, you know, this timeless, connected dimension. Somebody like Joshu is a great Zen master because he can live in both of these dimensions at the same time. We tend to get trapped in what I'm calling the human dimension, you know? So, you know, I have a friend of mine who worked for many years as a salesman. Actually, the person is my cousin. And he worked for many years as a salesman, like for 40 years as a salesman. And he won all these awards for being a good salesman. And he was like the top salesman. And then the company decided to move him to another sales region. And you think, well, so what? You know, my cousin was a very successful salesman in his region. He got like Salesman of the Year awards and things like this. Over the years, he had built up a huge client base. And of course, you know, you're paid, you get commission, you're paid on a commission basis. So my cousin was making a lot of money. He had worked his way up to making a very large income because he had built up his sales region. So they sent him, they said, you know, you've done such a good job, we're going to send you to this other region and let you build it up. But this is actually like a terrible blow, because his income plummeted, right? And they basically said, you did all this work and you were brilliant at it, now as your reward we're taking it all away from you and we want you to do it again here. And so he was in a terrible quandary, you know, because he had worked for this company for almost 40 years. And he had been so successful. And now he had to change, you know. He went through a real crisis, you know. My cousin doesn't do Zazen, you know. He doesn't have that resource, and he had some problems, you know. To be honest with you, he, you know, had some serious problems as a result of this. And, you know, I think he felt very trapped in his life. You know, that he had no way of getting out of this, you know, this small world that he was in. You know, it was like, I'm a salesman, I've been a successful salesman, I've been done an injustice, and now I'm trapped, right? You know. And I think people go through this all the time. You know, we can't get out of this, you know, we get into this perspective. In Zen we call this the small mind perspective. Small mind. You know, but you know, when you sit on the cushion, sometimes you get into this state where all of that falls away. It just seems very remote. And now you're in the moment, and the moment seems boundless, and it seems richly present and connected, and very supportive and welcoming. You know, and this other consciousness is so liberating when you feel trapped in your human world. I think people don't really know how to get out of the human world and enter into this bigger consciousness. You know, I think people develop substance abuse problems because it makes them feel like they're getting out of the small self world. You know, you drink and you feel opened up, but it's not a good solution. Or people develop other kinds of addictive behaviors or destructive behaviors. Somebody like Joshu, see, his teacher gives him asks him a question. And some of the questions in our life can't really be solved in the human realm, in the small self realm. You know, to find the solution, you have to sort of step out of that realm and enter this other realm, which is this Buddha mind realm. You feel trapped in what you know. And when you go into the Buddha realm, the Buddha mind realm, you step out of your knowledge and you enter this realm of like possibility or openness, receptiveness. Yeah? So, when Joshu's teacher asks him a question, he's able to move from the human realm into this Buddha realm very quickly and automatically. And so he's not trapped by the circumstances of his life so much, right? This is like the ideal kind of life, where the two aspects of the human being are in harmony or nourish one another, right? Nourish one another. You know, Joshu also had a human life. You know, Joshu had friends. He had his beloved teacher, Nansen, and they had a close personal friendship for many years. He probably liked certain kinds of foods, you know. He probably liked to do things with his spare time. I don't know. But he also had access to this other dimension. And I think culture becomes, societies become unhealthy when they forget about this other dimension. You know, we have so many problems as a society. People are very greedy. You know, I was reading just the other day that, you know, more and more people are being pushed out of the middle class, and wealthy people are more powerful and wealthy than ever, and you know, it's not a good, healthy society. You wonder, why do these people, you know, why are they so, they want wealth so much, you know? I mean, Bill Gates is worth like $40 billion. How much do you need, you know? And I do think that a lot of these people are driven by a kind of neurotic compulsions, you know? You know, I think sometimes people turn to things like money because they're looking for an opening. They're trying to get out of their traps, out of their mental boxes. And money is substituting for something else. You know, if you feel disconnected from the world, you know, money, you know, psychologists will tell you money is often a symbol of something else. It's really not, sometimes money's not about money. Money's about not getting, wanting money is about not getting loved, not feeling safe, not being happy. You know, money is a symbol, an unconscious symbol for so many things that we don't have, right? You know, so sometimes worries about money are really worries about many other things. Sometimes they're just about money. But I think in our society, money is so important to so many people, and they want to amass so much of it because they're so unhappy. I think unconsciously they feel that something is really missing in their lives, and they're pursuing it in the wrong way. You know, when you enter that timeless realm, when you enter that place where you feel very open and connected, you know, the kinds of fears that drive greed disappear. The kinds of desires that make people competitive disappear. And you're in this beautiful connected realm where compassion seems as natural as breathing. So, you know, if you want to understand what we do in Zen, you know, we're learning how to get back to this other consciousness, this other realm, which has always been there and which is part of who we are. You know, we really are like a frog. We're between two worlds. And if we don't come up for air sometimes, we aren't healthy. Well, meditation is about like coming up for air, right? This is about cultivating this other part of ourselves, which is really essential to the health. Cultivating Buddha mind is essential to being a healthy human being, I believe. And when we don't have access to this other consciousness, I think we develop all kinds of problems as people. So, something like a Zen center or something like a Sangha, such as we have here, is really like a school for cultivating a Buddha mind. And we have created a structure where it's possible to develop a part of yourself that wasn't developed in school, and it doesn't get very well developed on the job, you know, and even doesn't get particularly well developed in your family. You know, there's this other dimension to the human being which is really quite important. You have a name, but you're also nameless. And you have a birthday, but you're also, you know, basically a kind of, you also exist in another realm, you know, where you have no birth and no death, we say in Zen. And, you know, it's okay to have goals and desires. It's important. That's part of the human adventure. But also, it's also true that there's no such thing as victory or defeat. You know, there's this way of experiencing life which is absolutely breathtaking no matter how it turns out. So Zen is about getting access to this bigger horizon, this bigger horizon. Joshu puts his sandals on his head. Main subject. Nansen told the story to Joshu and asked his opinion. Joshu then took his sandals and, putting them on his head, went away. Nansen said, "If you had been there, the cat would have been saved." So basically, Joshu is somebody who can move between these two worlds with ease. You know, he's done a lot of zazen. And when he confronts obstacles, he isn't boxed in because he can access this larger horizon of consciousness. Secho's verse. He asked Joshu to complete the koan. It was their leisure time in Chang'an. The sandals on the head. Who is guest? Returning home, they were at rest.